Coming up, do you think God stays in heaven because he too lives in fear of what he's created here on earth? We return with Spy Kids 2, The Island of Lost Dreams, and this is Most Extreme Podcast.
Is it fast? Well, let me tell you, the listeners are strapped into the bubble. The hydro robot lifts the episode high into the air and spins it round and round as fast as the United States government will allow. The episode spins, turns, flips, and bounces, and then it podcasts you. I'm just trying to do my Bill Paxton impression because, rest in peace, Twister, great movie. Hi, welcome to Most Extreme Podcast, the show where we discuss and analyze the enigma that is a device that automatically makes you better at singing and can be controlled wirelessly from someone backstage. We're talking all the latest gadgets.
Yeah, so somehow a thing strapped to your belt can make your arms move.
Yeah, it sounds like more like a torture device, but for some reason it's used for pop songs because every 2000s movie has to have a song and dance number at the end. You're listening to the voice. It's Alejandro, Joaquin, and Brett Ellison. Hi, welcome.
Yes. Welcome.
Welcome to the show. We're here, yeah. That is one of the scenes where you're like, wait, what does this have to do with the plot? There wasn't like at any point in the movie where they're like, but we got to get to the dance show at the
end.
It's
so good, though. It's so good.
And it's also it's the Foops Foogly song, right? That she's like they do a remix.
Yeah,
to, right?
it was like a pop. I mean, it was a pop song tie-in for the movie, right? Like you said, like movies had to have it this time,
right?
But they kind of led into it with the Floop song earlier in the movie. And one thing that's fun about that, I was looking at the location where they filmed that. Of course, you know that the auditorium where that was filmed is, of course, in Austin.
Yeah, that's another thing that I love so much about. We'll get into it in a second, but the fact that another famous Texas filmmaker, Richard Linklater, makes an appearance in this movie as one of the like agents of OSS when all the parents get poisoned. Very and quickly, I was like, "It's Linklater."
I believe it's his daughter who I think I want to say was actually in Boyhood.
That's right.
She's in the movie as well. I believe she's one of the young spy kid operatives who attacks the Magna Men at the party when all the parents are. So yeah, very very Austin, all Austin all the way.
And we're of course we love Austin, we love it all. And well, here you've already been hearing the voice. The creator of Pagan Angel Network, Zach Smith, is with us.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. Well, I'm glad to be talking about this. We've already been talking about it. If you haven't read the title already, it's Spy Kids 2: The Island of Lost Dreams, and that goes down to me as one of the best subtitles of all time, up there with Revenge of the Fallen. What are some other ones?
Oh, man.
Ariel's Underwater Adventure. There's a lot of good ones is what I'm saying, people.
What was the Dr. Doolittle movie? I think it had a pretty epic title.
There was a Dr. Doolittle 2.
I think it's just called Doolittle.
We're talking about the one with
Tony Stark.
Tony Stark.
Yeah, where he grabs bagpipes out of a dragon's ass and he like shoves it out of it, and that was his idea. We talk a lot about Doolittle on this podcast.
My head is still trying to think back to like weirdly like just nondescript and confusing subtitles for sequels. Because that's the whole thing about like Island of Lost Dreams. I was reading a review and they pointed out like this title doesn't have anything to do with the movie.
No.
Like, there is an island.
Correct. We got an island.
Yeah.
And they sing a song at the end of the movie in the credits that talks about dreams, although it's just Isle of Lost Dreams, so they're just saying the name of the movie.
Just the idea of, like, Steve Buscemi's, like, this is his dream world, Like, is that it? I don't know.
I guess the only lost dream on the island was that he had a lost dream of, like, providing toys to children, and now he has to hide from his creations. But that's not dreams, plural. That's one dream.
That's true.
Right.
It's, like, pretty long dream. It's very intense. But here's my dream, and this is just more of a question for you, Zach, as we're getting into, like, our background in this movie. But I wanted to ask you personally about kind of your background on this film and everything. So do you think God stays in heaven because he, too, lives in fear of what he's created here on Earth?
Oh, man. When I was a kid, that line, I mean, I think it still hit some people pretty hard, but that line hit me so hard when I was a kid. Every time I'd watch it, I'd be like, oh, man.
It's one of those lines that you're just like, wow, that's in what? Wait, that's from what movie?
Yeah.
And one time I posted it on Facebook as the joke being like, it's from Spy Kids. And I forgot that I should never post on Facebook ever again. Mom's like, I don't think this is very nice that you be saying such a terrible thing.
Oh, no.
Anyway, you, Zach, we've known each other for many years. You are a filmmaker.
Yes.
You have a lot of background. And both of us kind of bonded over this movie from a very long time. And this is something that you – would you consider it's like in your top five or something? Is that right?
I don't really know where this movie falls in my like favorite movies, but what I would say is that this movie really had a very profound effect on my life. truly, this might be one of the most, if not the single most influential movie on my life when it comes to the fact that this is really the movie, honestly, that gave me a love of movies, really, and specifically, you know, more specifically, of filmmaking itself, an interest in that. When it was around this age, I didn't see the movie in theaters when it first came out. I actually saw it on DVD. This was maybe the first DVD that I ever saw. There's some interesting stuff about this movie when it comes to, like, technology and really a lot of shifts in technology from
big time
old stuff to digital that was happening at this time, and we can get into that. But like I said, I think it may have been the first DVD that I saw, but around that age, and in large part from seeing this movie was when I decided, and I was this. I think I would have seen it in early 2003, which means I would have been 11. And it was around that time that I decided I was interested in making movies. And really, you know, Robert Rodriguez, the director of Spy Kids 2 and, you know, some other movies that you may know him for, was really kind of my idol at that point. And it's like, you know, he was a writer director. And that was when I decided, you know, well, okay, I want to be a writer director as well. Brett, I guess, as you know, I'm, you know, calling you from K-Town, Koreatown in Hollywood, Los
Shout
Angeles.
Shout out to K-Town, baby.
Shout out to K-Town. I have pursued, Hollywood filmmaking. I'm not in Austin, but I pursued filmmaking. And more specifically, writing now is more of my interest, and television is more of my interest now. Not so much directing and film. But really, Spy Kids 2 for me was the movie that put me on the path that I am still on today. So where is it on my favorite movies? I don't know. But in terms of influential movies for me, this is really, really the one. So I'm excited to be featured on this episode.
Do you rewatch it a lot, Zach?
I will say I rewatched it a week ago in preparation for this recording. Before that, I think the last time that I had rewatched it was not that long before that, probably within maybe a year before that. I watched it. It's on Netflix as of this recording, and it's been on Netflix for a little while because I remember watching it with both of my sisters when I was in town. They live in Michigan, and I was visiting, and we all got together and put that movie on. But of course, you know, we own the DVD, and I really couldn't tell you how many times. I'm not a big, like, rewatcher of movies, but this is definitely one of those movies that I've seen over and over and over again, no doubt.
So when you're in a conversation with other people in L.A. in terms of, like, what are your favorite films, and you say Spy Kids 2, did everyone scoff, or are they like, yeah, respect, man?
I don't know. In my experience, I mean, again, this I know that you feel similarly, Brett, but I think that for people of our age, and Brett, you're a little younger than me, but I think of people our age and our generation, I don't think the story that I shared was, like, especially unusual. And we can get into some of the reasons why I think what Robert Rodriguez was doing at that time, I think, really connected with a lot of people. But I think I for sure, like, it has come up in conversation and somebody else has just been like, oh, yeah, like, no, I know exactly what you're talking about. And then, yeah, I'm sure there are the people who are just like, they laugh. They're like, what? What are you talking about? But that's, mm-hmm. you know, I know that if they don't know it, then they probably were not there in that moment.
Right. Alejandro, what about you? What is your background on this film? Because you're a big filmmaker guy as well.
Yeah. I mean, I saw this when I was really young. So I probably must have been like 10 or 9. And I remember, like, just seeing it. Like, my cousins had a copy. And so, like, we would see it sometimes at his house. Or it would just be playing on TV. And, but yeah, I remember growing up with a lot of, like, Robert Rodriguez movies without, like, I wasn't necessarily a fan, but they were just, like, the popular things and, like, they were everywhere. And, yeah, like, Sharkboy and Lava Girl, which is another great, film.
Well,
I remember, like, that being, like, the point where I was like, oh, wow, this, they just, they can do anything, especially with how Robert Rodriguez, his, just his production style is mm-hmm. so unique and cheap, but really fun. And just something about being a kid that you, like, get sucked into that really easily, mm-hmm. I think. But, yeah, I always liked this film. And, yeah, I did not realize that the God Stays in Heaven line was from this movie until right? I saw, like, a meme from, like, years ago where they talked about it.
The memes are
strong. Did you know
that
this is from this movie?
And it's so Steve Buscemi. I think this was actually probably the first Steve Buscemi role that I ever saw. But, you know, now, you know, having seen him in a million other movies that are, you know, in roles that are more iconic than this one, you go back and you see him in this movie and he doesn't show up until about exactly halfway through it. And you're just like, what? Is that Steve Buscemi?
And he's worked with Rodriguez before because he's in, like, Desperado.
Oh, yeah.
Stuff.
No,
yeah.
They're close. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And they're so, and he's close with Quentin Tarantino and, you know, they're all very close. And
Adam Sandler.
Share a lot of similar philosophies and things.
Yeah, no, for sure. Yeah, it's this
what
is
about
okay.
You, Brett?
Yeah, okay. So here's the thing. So I wrote down my own notes. So this is the greatest movie ever made. And let me explain.
Is that what you were trying to get me to say earlier when you were saying where does this fall in the top five?
Yeah,
number
so that
one
was,
obviously.
It was really hard to write notes for this episode because all of them were just like, so this is the greatest movie ever made. I love this film. I love this. Okay, here I'm going to get this. You want to get into my life? I rewatched this. I cried. I cried rewatching this movie. It is everything that I, like, believed in as a child. This is exactly what made me want to become a filmmaker. Both of you, I echo what you're saying, is that, like, Robert Rodriguez is just, like, pretty much the first director that I ever, like, saw and was like, oh, like, I love his work. It's the most nostalgic I've ever felt doing Most Extreme Podcast. It's the most existential I've felt watching any movie. It's just I'm felt joy, like, watching this. And so much of the crap that we had to watch for this show is just like, ugh, we have to do what? And then I watch this and I'm in tears because it's just like it brings me back. It's so good. Oh, man. And yeah.
And like,
Robert,
I just, like, they do something crazier than they did, like, the scene before, which just keeps it so entertaining to just watch at any point.
Yeah.
Yeah. And very much, when a lot of people talk about, like, so who are your favorite directors? And it's never really, like, what do I like most of their greatest hits in terms of filmography? It's, like, what are their, like, beliefs and, like, their ways of film that, like, make them unique and, like, what are their approach to this art form? And Robert Rodriguez is always in my top three, pretty much. And anything he touches is very much in that boat.
Yeah, I think depending on what your relationship is to movies, why you watch them, that's going to obviously inform, you know, which creators appeal to you. And I think you could definitely say, like, you know, there's a lot of crap that you could talk about Rodriguez, and I would agree with most of that crap. But he's definitely like a filmmaker's filmmaker in that sense that he's really one of those 90s indie icons. along with, you know, like Linklater, like you mentioned, Tarantino, some of the other people from that era.
Yeah. Alejandro, do you want to get into sort of his style kind of stuff?
Yeah. Like, he works on such a different level when it comes to just, redefining what's possible within the power of movies. Because, you know, I think that, like, so many people, when they see this, like we talked about, they laughed at, they would, like, see it as childish, as, like, cheap. But, like, that's kind of, like, what makes him fun. And it's kind of, he's just a really big DIY filmmaker and kind of, like, is not afraid to do anything. And you see it with his other films, like Sin City, the whole film looks like the comic book. And even with the stuff he's done with Machete and all the gore and, you know, silliness that comes
with it. Yeah, it's all fun and games.
But he's just... It's just, yeah, it's all fun and games, but he does really have, like, this just natural flow of imagination and just, like, being able to touch on every little part of filmmaking. And, like, I'm also, like, a big fan of his work in The Mandalorian, too, and so glad that
he's coming back.
He was asked to direct with that because I think he was amazing with that.
There's something that's so, like... I was saying, like, when watching that episode specifically that he directed and that he's worked on it, it feels so... And the same with Spy Kids. It very much just feels like a kid kind of just playing with action figures in, the sandbox.
It's so Austin.
Exactly. Yeah.
But that's very much, like, that gets back to, like, the root of why we wanted to be filmmakers in the first place is just, like, just be able to, like, create worlds. And that's sort of very existential in this movie that he's kind of saying that through this film. With characters like Buscemi and the Lies, it's like, I got into this to create worlds and create things I could never could, but then, like, I got manipulated by the studio, which is what OSS is supposed to mean and all that, so.
Right.
And having that kid,
like,
mentality.
When
again.
You, exactly, when you're a director and you want to make films, you automatically, I think a lot of people start limiting themselves of, what can I do with budget, what can I do with, you know, like, how many actors can I get, but he just, like... Even he doesn't really look at the budget and just wants to do what he wants to do and finds a way to keep it within the budget. And for this film, he did not ask for, like, a larger budget, even though it was a sequel. He just wanted, like, more creative control. Mm-hmm. So, like, he picked visual companies that were a little less known and, like, getting started just into the industry. And then he started also his Troublemaker Studios, which is the theme of the theme park in the first scene.
Yeah.
Was this the first Troublemaker Studios film?
The first one, I think, is the first Spy Kids.
Okay.
But then, like, the joke of it being, like, his own version of Disneyland is in this movie.
Right. It's very, it's just the right type of self-indulgent. Yeah. I mean, I guess that's a subjective thing to say, but for me, it's just the right type of self-indulgent.
We've joked about doing a Brack theme park for years. Yeah,
exactly. It really does. Brett, I mean, most of the listeners are not going to totally get this reference that I'm making, but... long story short, years ago when Brett and I were younger, we ran summer camps, week-long summer camps for kids elementary and through high school, teaching them filmmaking. And it's crazy in retrospect how much Spy Kids 2 reminds me of those movies.
I was just about to say that.
That the kids made. And it's not, again, I just got through praising Spy Kids 2 and saying how good it is. And it's not that I'm saying, the movies we made were so good. Rather, what I'm saying is, I keep using the word Austin, but just that sense that it has of being so local and of just being like, these were just the locations that they had. Because when we were running those camps, we would just film them at, like, our house or your house or, you know, whatever institution it was that was hosting the week. And it's like, okay, we're doing a Western, but we need to do it at this like, you know, private school that's hosting us. We need to have a Western here. And the way that the kid actors, and this goes for the actors in Spy Kids 2 as well, the way that they just jump into that and they don't let the, like, you know, like Alejandro was saying, some of the production values and some of the fact that it's like, well, clearly they're not in an island. They're just in Austin somewhere.
Costa Rica.
They don't let them take that, or they don't let that take them out of it. They just jump full into it, and the sort of earnest way that they deliver their lines and stuff, it's really iconic, and it's something that you don't get that with like actors or with actors that are more seasoned, let's say.
That's a very good way of putting it.
Yeah.
Well, you don't get that with actors who maybe have been around the block a few more times.
That's true. We've mentioned it on our very first Spy Kids episode, but I definitely feel like, and especially in this movie too, but Carmen and Najuni's relationship feels very natural, and it's because they've known each other for years before even making the movies.
That's a really good point.
They're just like family friends, and so then they go and film this movie that it doesn't feel like, sister, what are we doing? You know, it feels very like natural in terms of their relationship. It's really cool just seeing how they bounce off of each other. I definitely like this more than the first one. I think just because it gets to that bigger existential bit of like, this is why we make movies in the first place, at least for me.
Yeah, I think it's successfully, I don't know, it's been a little while since I've gone back and seen the first one. I would say, from what I remember, I would say that they're both, I think, pretty successful as kid movies and as movies for adults to watch with their kids. I would say that the first one is maybe a little more successful as a movie for grownups, and the second one is maybe a little more successful as a movie for kids.
Hmm.
I know that as a kid, I liked the second one better, and I think that that is still the case, just because of kind of the personal biases that I've mentioned. I do think that the first one is a little tighter in terms of just the way everything fits together and thematically.
Right. Agreed.
You mentioned some of the kind of moving themes that are in the second one, and I agree. But then you get stuff like the whole extended, like, Jason and the Argonauts / Raiders of the Lost Ark, like, cavern with the skeletons and all of that stuff. And it's don't get me wrong, like, I loved that stuff as a kid, and I still do, and I think it'd be a much worse movie without that in there. But objectively, from the perspective of, like, Aristotle's unity or whatever, it's like, why is any of that in the movie? It does not belong at all.
Sure.
It's total nonsense. Like, he just wanted put these scenes in there. And I can imagine that if I was, a professional film critic now going in and watching Spy Kids 2 for the first time, I might not enjoy it as much as I definitely did as a kid.
Yeah. And that's the beauty of all of Rodriguez's movies to me, is that he's not really working. Well, he is from time to time, but he gets to do so much of his own thing that, of course, if he was showing this movie to like a test audience or to like executives, they'd be like, Bobby, we got to cut like half of this.
And
none
I think
of it makes any sense.
And I think it's remarkable that he even had the idea to like include these scenes in the first place, because he somehow knew on some level that like kids would love this stuff. Right. Even though for me, if I was going to try to write this movie, that those scenes wouldn't even occur to me, because it would just be like, well, my adult brain would just be like, well, what? Like, that's nonsense. That doesn't belong in this movie.
Yeah.
And I would be so wrong, but I would be right and wrong at the same time. But that's, I think, one of the things that's really unique about him as a writer and director, is the way that he's somehow able to really get to the heart of what an actual kid would write and would want to see in this movie.
Right. And that's the beauty of it, is this feels like a movie a child made.
Yes.
And
in
very
the best
much,
way yeah. possible.
No, and that might sound like an insult, but that's
right.
literally
that's
a compliment.
That's what's so great about it. Another movie that I think gets this really right is The Fifth Element. And in the sense, if I know my anecdote correctly, The Fifth Element actually was basically written by the director. I think it's Besson. It was written by him when he was a kid. That was just a script he wrote, a story he wrote when he was a kid. And then as an adult, you know, when he was more successful, he just decided to make it into a real movie. And I think it's the best movie he's ever made, because it has that purity of vision to it that a lot of his other movies, like Lucy or whatever, where it's like, it's something really special, I think, when people are able to. I think as a writer, a lot of a writer's task is to get back to that sort of unself-awareness and purity of vision that we had when we were kids that has gotten, you know, we needed to grow up past that and grow beyond that, but you need to be able to come back around to that sort of purity and stop writing things for other people, I guess.
Yeah.
Or for what you think other people want.
Yeah, I think, like, Robert Rodriguez definitely lets himself do whatever he wants in the writing stage. And, you know, I guess just he just kind of figures he's going to get it done somehow. and I think that's just great, you know.
It helps that his wife at the time was also the producer. So...
Yeah, I think she was the producer for, like, all of his movies. In fact, I don't know, but I almost wonder if, I don't know. I wonder, like, what the relationship was between their marriage, you know, coming together and him starting filmmaking. You know, I don't know whether he would have gotten his career off the ground without her or not. I'm not sure.
Are you saying, honey, I'm making movies? And she's like, okay, dearie.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it really does get down to how much of a family thing it was for him, and the fact that I don't know if he was the one who put Danny Trejo on the map, but he definitely went a long way to doing that. And I think Danny Trejo is just his cousin.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Man. Yeah, he needs to be.
And he was like, wow, you have a face. You need to be in movies. And he was right.
Okay, so I know this episode's coming out a couple weeks before The Book of Boba Fett, which Rodriguez is producing and directing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to make a bet right now, Trejo's in Star Wars.
Oh, that would be great.
and if I'm right...
Don't get my hopes up, bro.
I have a feeling he's in it. It would be perfect if he was.
It kind of feels wrong that he hasn't been already.
If he was a bounty hunter, come on. It's going to happen. I think because he's... if it doesn't happen, Kathy Kennedy, call me. We know you listen every week.
That's right.
Well, it's interesting because it seems like everybody else was very pumped to make this movie, because I watched the behind the scenes for this, and Antonio Banderas is talking about how much fun he had working on the first movie, and that they seem... It's like, he's like, yeah, it's like working... I mean, we're literally working with a family of the Rodriguezes, and we're kind of, you know... we feel like a family unit as well, so it didn't seem like anybody, like toned it in terms of performance. Maybe they didn't really understand the direction of, like, okay, so you're Ricardo Montalban, your wheelchair is gonna fly and this is your first movie since Naked Gun, so action.
Yeah, I think actually you get really the opposite of phoning it in the sense that, and you see this with other filmmakers, this is a sort of very much of a Tarantino trope. But you see, you know, filmmakers from these type of people, but it's like people are coming on Spy Kids 2 and they don't care what the role is, how big it is, what they're doing or what they're getting paid. They just want to do it. They just want to be there. They just want to have fun. They just want to be in Spy Kids 2.
And it's just a testament to how Robert Rodriguez must be as a director, like that you would be willing to just work with him. Even if it's just a kid's project, because it's him.
Yeah, I mean, you see, who is it? George Clooney. I don't think he's in this one, but George Clooney, like, just keeps making cameos.
Yeah,
and I think it's, I don't know what the relationship is him through From Dusk Till Dawn. I don't know what Rodriguez's involvement in Dusk Till Dawn was, but I'm guessing that may have been the connection there, but... Clearly, you know, they were just friends, and he was like, hey, can you put me in one of the Spy Kids movies? Hey, can you put me in another one of the Spy Kids movies? You know? Because I'm sure Rodriguez's budget did not have the movie to afford George Clooney properly.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, I think.
Definitely feels like he should come back if they ever decide to do something else. I don't know. Maybe George Clooney's in Star Wars. I don't know. That would be something, too.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, okay, so we want to talk a little bit, especially about, as you know, this movie, as we've talked about already, sort of changed a lot of in terms of the industry stuff. This was the second major motion picture shot entirely on digital video instead of film. Mm-hmm. The first one ever was Star Wars Episode II: Attack of the Clones, which was released in the same year.
And it looks so much better than of the Clones. So much better. I'm sorry, Lucas, but... It's pretty crazy considering how cheap this movie was and how experimental it was. It really got a lot of the stuff right the very first go. That you know, that Attack of the Clones did not get so right.
Yeah, and apparently Rodriguez was testing the technology during the reshoot for the first Spy Kids film, and was friends with Lucas. Like, mm-hmm. was on set with him, seeing how he was using it. And he's like, "Oh wow, yep. this could make things a lot easier if yeah, I'm I want you know, that. Especially if you know you don't have to reset." You can just go immediately to the next take. It wouldn't take that long. I could use this technology for something. And yeah, like you were saying, does it a lot better.
And less than 20 years later, you're kind of a freak now if you shoot on film. I mean, there almost nobody does. It's completely changed around. That stuff is so just digital, you know, it's just that workflow is just so standard now. And this was really one of the movies that really figured out how to do that. It's really, like, it's kind of hilarious, but it really is, like, a historical film in that way.
It's interesting, too, because the one thing is that Spy Kids 1 came out, and just to put it into time, Kieran said that Spy Kids 1 came out in March 18th, 2001. This became filming in October of 2001. So it was a really quick turnaround. Hmm. So they had, like, pre-production for, like, a couple months.
Wow.
Like, immediately going straight into it. Which, I guess because it's, you know, this comes out in 2002, so it's, like, a year later you get another Spy Kids movie. And then we don't get Spy Kids 3 until 2004, is that right?
Sounds right,
2003.
Yeah.
No, they come out a year from each other.
Oh, really? Wow, that's crazy. Wow. Time felt so slow passing when I was 11.
Oh, right? Yeah, I was just thinking the same thing.
It felt like years and years and years and years between all of them.
Well, here's sort of an answer to one of our questions, is that the reason it's called the Island of Lost Dreams is because grown-ups like Rodriguez would reminisce about the gadgets and toys they wish they had as kids, such as the Skycopter or, like, the Treehouse, which I love, and eventually Lost Dreams. That they would have as they grew up. So that's sort of the whole idea.
Interesting.
Which I love the gadgets in this movie.
They're awesome. That's another thing that I should mention while we're on the subject of sort of the switch from film to digital. The movie at a textual level very much has this stuff on its mind. It's all about technology, the good and bad effects of technology, how we view technology, all the way through to the, you know, the song tie-in, Cash Grab at the end. Where they're like, oh, you know, this gadget that you thought was making you into a pop star wasn't really, you know, you just have a great voice. Which, you know, I think Alexa Vega did, you know, of course, she did record that song herself.
Right.
And she was actually like a gymnast, I think, so she did all those dance moves herself. But yeah, it very much has technology on the brain. That's one of the big themes that is happening in this movie. And it's funny, again, 20 years later, how much a lot of the technologies that were new at that time are just so standardized now, and we just accept them. And there's so many technologies now that we have. Like, there's the joke about the watch that does everything, but it doesn't tell time, and that feels a lot like, you know, my iPhone or whatever. It's like, who really uses their phone to call people anymore?
Right.
And yet we have our phones on us all the time.
Yeah, I was just gonna say that the watch was really funny too, but yeah, I do like that part that they in the movie they introduce all these gadgets and you know, of course they have the little gadget fight in the beginning, and then they kind of like take away the gadgets in the whole middle part. So like, yeah, I really like that they do that. And almost not making it like this, you know, bigger like set piece, like second sequel movie. But you know, they're continuing kind of their journey.
It's a little bit like you said. He had the option, you know, to do a sequel, and instead of trying to have a bigger budget, he said, "No, I want a smaller budget. I just want to do it this way."
And.
Right.
Yeah, there's so many things also that just kind of stand out to me in terms of course, like, you know, the sort of the visual language of the film, but also just in terms of the gadgets of that kids kind of stuff. Number one, Ralph, the coolest. I'm not even joking. I think
there's the best scene in the movie.
Yeah, I was about to say
one of the best scenes in the movie.
I'm no joke. Yes. We were watching, there's a YouTube channel called Pretty Much It that does commentary tracks, and they were right where they're like, this is like better than like the Spider-Man movies that was coming out. The scene of Ralph like infiltrating the OSS lab.
Yeah.
There's a whole bit where you're following him almost like Spider-Man, and then he like gets caught on like a railing, and the camera like pulls back again, and then goes back to follow him. It's all like POV following behind him, and I'm like, this is like legit great filmmaking. Like, why are people like looking at this film as just like cheesy? I'm like, you need to like look past the helicopter pigtails, you know?
Yeah, that's one of the things about being on, you know, on the cusp of the technology and trying to do new things with CGI and find ways to pull off new effects, is sometimes you get it right. You know, sometimes you don't get it right and the movie looks awful in retrospect. But I think as this movie shows, you know, sometimes Rodriguez got it right in terms of really being on ahead of the curve using like new technology and new effects.
That's true. And also, I like that the majority of the island parts, when it's not Austin, is definitely shot on location in, like, Costa Rica and in, like, Big Bend National Park, which makes, like, the topography of the island make no sense, but it definitely is really cool and gives that, like, that James Bond or, like, Indiana Jones kind of vibe, which
yes,
I really like.
Yes, definitely, yeah. That's a lot of fun. That was a lot of fun as a kid.
Definitely, I like any movie like that's shot on location, of course. But of course, there's nothing like the Goonies and stuff where it's like kids going on a treasure hunt slash adventure. And if you shoot it like you're really there, then it really comes off as real.
Yeah, I love the when they invade the president's banquet, and their escape plan is just to put magnets on their head and bring a giant magnet. And just to leave.
You know? And I have to say, shout out to the way the Magna Men like wiggle slightly when the ship that's taking them away, like it kind of like makes a little turn, and it the way that it's composited is just so clearly like a composite, but he makes sure to give the Magna Men like a little wiggle, like they're kind of being thrown around by their own momentum. It's such a great shot. Ugh.
It's definitely one of those things that makes me very mad when people really take things like the Infinity Stones and stuff so seriously, and then they look at this as garbage, and I'm like, this is the same thing. Like, this is just as dorky.
I don't want to dunk on Tom Cruise. I don't want to dunk on Mission Impossible. I'm sure if I actually sat down and gave the movies the time of day and the right frame of mind, I would enjoy them and appreciate them. I know Chris McQuarrie is a legit dude and all of that.
Yeah,
but
I've talked to him before. He's really nice.
When I, you know, sort of when I was on vacation in Mexico, actually, and my friends were watching one of the Mission Impossible movies, and I kind of sat down and watched it for a while, and I was like, this is just Spy Kids, but without the Spy Kids. Like, why would, if I want to watch, like, some corny, ridiculous, like sub James, I mean, and James Bond can famously be very corny and ridiculous, but if I want to watch something that's even more corny and goofy than James Bond, why am I going to watch like the quote unquote grown up version of it? Why not just go straight to the kid version of it?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the things that I will say, one thing that if I have to give like one note when rewatching this that I don't think works as well in this one is, I don't think Mike Judge is that great of an actor.
That's tough. You know, this was his first acting role, live action acting role. And he, you know, of course, he and Rodriguez were friends, and Robert Rodriguez was like, I really want you to be, because I think he had a cameo in the previous one, in the first Spy Kids movie. And he was like, I really want you to be like the major villain. And Mike Judge was like, I don't think that's a good idea. Like, I'm not an actor, you realize. And he was like, no, you can do it, trust me. And I think from what I recall, like, Mike Judge had a lot of, like, sort of stage fright doing this role. So,
yeah, that regardless might be what I've been
noticing. Regardless of whether or not he has chops as an actor, which, you know, in his opinion, he doesn't, it's cool to see that, because it's just cool to see somebody, like, putting themselves out there as the main actor.
Right.
Because their friend really wanted them to do it.
That's my favorite trope ever, is directors in movies that are directed by, like, other famous directors.
That's my favorite thing ever. Yeah.
Like, Fincher does that a lot. And a bunch of other
directors in his movies.
Yeah, I love it. It is just so crazy that it's like, wait, this is the guy who created King of the Hill and Beavis and Butthead.
Yeah. And you're right. You could definitely tell that he's like, like, why am I doing this? Like, is this really?
I'm an animation guy.
I'm not an A-lister. I'm not even an actor at all. But I think he gives it a good shot.
He made Office Space, so
and I do. Yeah, of course, he's a classic. But I will say I do enjoy his performance in the movie.
I know he's a little bit more of a 90s guy, but he did make some stuff in the 2000s, Mike Judge. He's made Silicon Valley, that's really funny.
Yeah, Silicon Valley would be his, I think, sort of most recent thing that was kind of a big deal.
So, if you don't know Mike Judge, that's kind of his vibe of comedy, so he's really smart. I think people just think Beavis and Butthead, and then they don't think farther than that. But I'm like, Office Space or Idiocracy is like really smart.
Yeah, and I think they're a little bit like, they're not the Simpsons, right? They're kind of like the alt Simpsons. They're not the thing that everybody knows and everybody has seen. Their Office Space is more of like a cult classic. Even King of the Hill, I think, never really got the wide accolades and attention maybe that some people think it deserved. It was a little bit closer to, again, like a cult classic.
Yeah, for sure. But you mentioned before sort of that Harryhausen's kind of look. I really love how, you know, just throwing things on screen and giving them a new spin is super cool. Especially like, what we're saying, creating different worlds, morphing what you know is new. The idea that they shot that live army of skeletons as like on a real rock formation with two young actors on safety wires and the computer generated skeletons added later is like with three dozen different shots. Like, to me, that's filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
Like an idea, like, and a reason I think people our age are so attached to this thing is that it's just so creative.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that it's very much a blank check of just like somebody throwing out like so many ideas. And in his essence, like, he is a director who looks at what the studio is doing and is able to take the financial risk of making everything himself. Famously, I believe Rodriguez got his start by, like, putting himself through, like, medical examinations in order to, like, fund his own films. He has all these, like, scars all over his body because he, like, needed to make movies. And so he got paid for using medical, like, surgeries and stuff so that people could practice on him. So people,
he really put all into it.
Literally his whole body into this. And I think with this movie, and I think with even stuff to an extent, the later Spy Kids and Shark Boy, and just even stuff like Sin City, is very much just looking at the studio and saying, like, have you guys forgotten, like, why we're making movies in the first place? Like, where's the joy? It's still a business at the end of the day, but that creative childlike wonder, I think, is the reason that I'm so drawn to him.
Yeah, I know this is a 2000s podcast, but it's really a 90s kind of that 90s grunge DIY aesthetic and philosophy really coming through.
And you don't see it that often anymore. That's why it makes him so specific.
No. I mean, if you look at Tarantino, you know, Tarantino's retiring, you know, a lot of these.
I think he's gonna have a Miyazaki sequence where he's gonna keep saying, "I'm retiring," and then be like, "All right, one more."
Yeah.
Because he doesn't know how to do anything else.
Who was it that also retired for a while and then came back? Soderbergh, right? Soderbergh would be another famous one of these 90s indie darlings. And he was retired for a while, but I think he did make his comeback.
It's very much, and that's what I love about these kind of directors that keep coming up on our show and all these things. It's like people who, like, their process of doing these films is they understand how painful and, like, mentally exhausting it is so that they try to retire. But then when they retire, they realize that, like, I can't do anything else. I have to do film. So it's my favorite.
So some, like, really interesting stuff we found out was that we were talking about the theme park being the Troublemaker Studios theme park, but he actually originally was gonna try to have the real Disneyland as the setting for it, but Disney did not allow him to do that, which I'm glad because I like that they did the Troublemaker Studios. I love the little parts that
he wouldn't have had as much freedom to like get really ridiculous with the rides. Yeah, because he would have had to stick to real rides. Yes.
Yeah, there would have been like not allowed him to do any of that. We talked about Richard Linklater and the cameo. So one of the gold items that Carmen picks up and tosses away when they're in that chamber, that gold treasure chamber, is actually a prop from the Indiana Jones Raiders of the Lost Ark movie. Which, direct reference to that. And another direct reference to these kind of older movies was the sword fight with the skeletons, which is a nod to the legendary stop-motion animator Ray Harryhausen, and who created the sort of... I don't know if you guys have ever seen this, but it's a stop motion of skeletons fighting with swords.
Mm-hmm. Is it Jason and the Argonauts?
In the movie. Yes, Jason and the Argonauts. Okay. But yeah, which, like, if you look at the scene, it looks very similar to the film. And did you guys ever notice the name of the father, Gregorio Cortez, who's actually the name of this really old film that Edward James Olmos is in? It's like this old Western, and it's called The Ballad of Gregorio Cortez. So I thought it was really cool that he just stole the name and put it on the Cortez's family. And this is a little like off track, but Robert Rodriguez has this like super maxed out garage that is his editing suite for the Troublemaker Studios.
It's like literally his backyard. This is it.
Which just goes to show how much it is a part of his life. Mm-hmm. And yeah, he had a little kind of behind the scenes videos of cooking recipes and like during the production of Sin City while editing it. Which is just like so funny.
It is really funny.
Do you want to show it, Brett?
I won't show it just because I don't want to get it, but it's pretty funny because you're just seeing him like sitting in his editing bay. Like, so when the movie's rendering, what I do, it'll be 3 a.m. and I sometimes get the hankering for some breakfast tacos. And then it'll be like he shot it on like, it'll be like, it'll show him like, so what do you want to do is you want to start with the eggs here. Sometimes
he was the first vlogger.
Sometimes I'll like to make my own tortillas, but today I got a pack from the store, and it's like they're just like somewhere in
the
behind the scenes.
That's how ahead he was of the curve.
Yeah, he was filming YouTube cooking videos. It's just so funny that there's so many of these on the edit or on the DVD for Sin City that you would have to find them and just be like, "What the crap are these doing?"
Yeah, that actually before we wrap up, that is one thing I want to mention in brief is the history around DVDs, because that's a very 2000s thing, and I know this is a 2000s podcast, so I feel remiss if we didn't discuss it.
Yeah, we talked about it a decent amount, but definitely that idea of like the two disc DVDs extra with commentary and all that is kind of gone.
Yes, this was like, again, I think this was the first DVD I ever saw, and it was certainly the first DVD I ever owned. In fact, I think this was the movie that my sisters and I lobbied our parents to finally buy a DVD player, because we wanted to see the bonus features on Spy Kids 2, because at the time, that was a thing, bonus features. That was a really big selling point. Mm-hmm. And again, for me and, you know, for those of us, as we've discussed, who were interested in filmmaking, Robert Rodriguez would do his thing. I think he called it 10-minute film school or something like that. And he would always put these bonus features on the DVDs of his movies. And it was really just sort of, you know, your standard behind the scenes type of thing. But he had a spin on it where he kind of did it as a like one DIY, you know, person to another. And it was kind of a, here's how you could do something like this. Here's how I do this. Here's kind of my philosophy. Here's how you could do something like that. And to an 11-year-old kid, that was so cool and so mind-expanding to really see a director, never mind that it was also a director who, you know, I thought made a pretty cool movie, but to see a director kind of talking to me, a kid, and saying, here's what I do, you know, here's here's how you could do something similar to that. And I know he did that on a lot of his movies. I think he, I'm sure he, like you said, I'm sure he did it on Sin City and other movies that weren't, you know, marketed to kids. But for those, for that DVD, just being able to go in and watch, you know, his how-tos on all of these different things, and here's how we did this scene, here's how we did the effects here, was so, so cool. And that's something that, you know, maybe as you guys have discussed before on this show, is really gone now, I think, just because we don't really do bonus features anymore.
Or commentary.
I guess like there's YouTube, and but I don't see really the same kind of thing anymore where that sort of insight is being used to really sell you on the movie itself.
I think, we have like the featurettes now that come sometimes, but they're more like commercials for the movie rather than like
it's been a long time
behind the scenes or
personally
anything.
Since I've watched really anything like that.
And so that's why you make good breakfast tacos, Zach. That makes a lot of sense. From a very young age.
It all comes together. I didn't want to bring that up.
Mom,
but
I'm making breakfast tacos like Bobby Rodriguez told me. he's definitely... we've talked about it a lot just in terms of... That's, like, the only reason why you would get a DVD now is to, like, get the bonus feature stuff. Mm-hmm. And even a little bit different, but, like Shyamalan would always put some of his home movies that he made as a kid on his DVDs, and I always appreciated that, to be like, I've been doing this like as old as you are now, like I'm a child making films in my backyard, and that was really impactful too when he was, you know, making good movies. But
Which was around the same time.
I did go to the beach. I am older, that's right. should we talk about the box office? Do you want to talk about that, Alejandro?
Yeah, I mentioned it real quick. For the box office for the year that it came out in the month, August 2002, it did not hit number one in the box office. That one, coincidentally, went to Signs, which was the Shyamalan movie.
Came out five days before this.
Yes, just 5 days.
It made $186 million when it came out.
Back when Mel Gibson was a person.
Yes.
Sorry, Mel.
Oh, you said, what do you say, Triple X?
Yes, Triple X was number two in box office, which is the Xander Cage.
That's a Vin Diesel movie, right?
Movie, yeah. Vin Diesel, Xander Cage.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
Xander Cage.
Are those good? Have any of you guys seen those?
I have not. You know, I've heard they're pretty, like extreme, you know. I guess they would be a good fit for your show.
We could call that episode Most XXX Extreme Podcast. But everyone's gonna be like, those naughty boys.
The same people who criticized your Steve Buscemi meme on Facebook will not approve.
I used to love Most Extreme Podcast until the Xander Cage episode. Those boys went too risque.
We'll talk about risque. Number three, which on the that right in front of Spy Kids 2, was the Austin Powers in Goldmember film. Came at number four.
I finally watched the Austin Powers movies because they were all on Netflix. Not good.
Was that the one with Beyonce?
Yeah, the funny part of that one is the opening where it has, like, Tom Cruise, Steven Spielberg, Britney Spears. Like, the whole idea is it being, like, they're making a movie out of the first Austin Powers, but with, like, huge stars. Danny DeVito is, like, playing Dr. Evil. But I watched, like, all three of them, and I didn't laugh, like, at all.
Yeah, Mike Myers is definitely funny sometimes. Like, I'll definitely give him that.
I will say anything with Dr. Evil made me laugh, but I did not find, like, the majority of... But all three of them funny. I was like, what is the joke here? Is that he wants to have sex all the time?
The Beyonce one, I feel like nobody ever, I think, really liked that one. But everyone is like, oh, yeah, it was the Beyonce one. Beyonce was in it.
Right.
I think that's the only thing that anyone knows Panther. About it.
Right. And then she's the Pink Panther, and she's married to Jason Statham in that movie. That's the only other thing I can remember that she's acted in until, The Lion King?
She was in the Pink Panther, too?
Yes.
The first Pink Panther with Steve Martin.
Yeah. No, yeah. I remember they tried
to reboot the second one. I can't remember.
It was the one where there's any of the Steve Martin ones. The pink diamond that gets stolen, I think. I think it's the second one.
I think that's all of them.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I don't know.
Wait, what were some other things that came out around this time?
Around this time, My Big Fat Greek Wedding was number 5 in the box office.
Really? Wow.
Yes.
I thought that was like from the 80s for a really long time.
That's such a throwback.
I got that movie and Big Fat Liar always mixed up.
Because they both have big in it?
Yes,
that's basically. Interesting, actually, because...
and fat?
Yeah, big and
even
fat.
Even though this was the 2000s, you know, Big Fat Greek Wedding was another one that really, if I'm not mistaken, was really kind of that sort of 90s do-it-yourself. I think the star wrote it herself, and I think it famously had, like, no budget, which is why it was such an enormous financial success, because, you know, they didn't... It was pure profits, basically. They didn't need to... that's kind of really a Spirit of Rodriguez type of movie, actually, around that same time.
Yeah. Good movie.
Yeah.
I enjoy it.
Yeah. I think they tried to do like a sequel or something that didn't more recently that wasn't so successful. But
I think they did a sequel. Spy Kids. At the same time as the Big Fat Liar sequel came out called Bigger Fatter Liar.
Wait, was there a Big Fat Liar sequel? Is that real, or are you trolling me?
No. It's like a straight-to-Redbox kind
of
movie.
Yes, it has none of the original cast in it.
No, wow. And instead of about movies, it's about video games.
Oh.
We talked about it on a previous episode. Anyway.
So you're the world's expert.
On our Big Fat Liar episode. That's such a crazy time in film.
Yes, and
it's just so weird.
And also, Stuart Little 2, Men in Black 2, and Country Bears came out
either that month
or the month before. Yes. So
Country Bears was Disney's less successful trial run for Pirates of the Caribbean.
Yes.
Yeah. Some people have been defending that movie. They're like, it's good. And I'm like, I remember seeing it in theaters and being like, what?
I mean, I'm just surprised people remember it existed, because I think Pirates of the Caribbean kind of like wiped that off the map in people's memories. Like, what is that, a year? Pirates of the Caribbean was 2003, 2004?
That sounds about right.
It was shortly thereafter.
Did you guys know that Stuart Little 2 is 120 minutes? Wow. It is real short. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't remember much happening.
Nice and sweet. I miss the 90-minute movie, man. We need more of those. I guess, wait, the last thing, wasn't the last Venom 90 minutes or something? It was, really short.
That's right,
and people were like, and everyone was like, it was good. It was 90 minutes. Like, that was the...
That was everyone's favorite thing about it, that it was over quickly.
Yes.
Oh, man. I've defended Men in Black 2 for being pretty decent. Not as good as the first one, but I like it. Okay. Well, we're down to it. You know what time it is.
Wait, what?
Oh. I've been wanting to talk about this for a little. Okay, we're talking. Get ready. Kids Meal Corner. Hit it!
Oh, man.
The Kids Meal Corner.
What you gotta tell Joe Biden right now?
What's up, baby? Take me out to dinner.
Hey, yo. What you gonna do when you see Joe Biden in the Oval Office?
I'm gonna give him a big old kiss.
Hey, yo.
Olive Garden, when you're here, you're family.
And we're back. Wow. I can't believe it. We did the whole...
I'm about to learn something new because I didn't know about it.
This is my dream now, is to say Kids Meal Corner and then we play an entire album from start to finish.
just like some Tom Petty album just comes on.
It's just like Kids just Meal Corner whole, and then all the of entire... Good Kid Mad City, like the entire hour and a half.
Just the entire B movie plays.
No. Yeah, just the audio, and you're like, what is happening? Oh my gosh. I gotta do it. Okay.
And we're back.
I just think that'd be great. Right, we're back. Okay, so they did a kids' meal, of course, for this movie. The cool thing about it is that there were 6 different kids' meals. All of them were different gadgets. Like, one is like cool eyewear, one is really cool, like kind of DIY, almost like a, looks like a data pad. And the other thing that I think is really cool about it is that all the six toys go together and they make a Ralph. So you can have a Ralph.
Oh my goodness.
Oh wow.
That you, if you get all six toys. So very cool. Like it a lot. I don't know
and
if you can do
it. Smash the Ralph to traumatize your rival.
This is also around the time I watched some of the commercials for this. This is also around the same time that they did what's called the like in 2001 they started the Mighty Kids Meal. I don't know if you remember this.
Oh, of course.
It was like a variant of the Happy Meal because Burger King had did something called the Big Kids Meal, which is basically just like it was designed for children who felt like they had outgrown the traditional Happy Meal. So like you would get like a full McDouble or like six McNuggets as their entree and then like Go-Gurt. Bringing that back, it was basically just like, oh, you know what, we need to give kids more McDonald's. How do we do this? The Mighty Kids Meal. I don't remember the last time I've even had a kids meal, to be honest. Well, I've had a kids meal and just not from McDonald's, but I don't know, do people go, are the toys any good? I don't know.
I've learned a lot about the history of toys that I've missed that sounded cool just from listening to y'all's back catalog of episodes.
There's been a lot of Kids Meal Corner drops.
Yeah, if anybody has wait a kids second, I missed that. I wanted those toys.
I still want them. Anyways, well, speaking of stuff, well, thanks, Zach, again for coming on the show, for sure.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you. Glad we could make it happen.
Well, we do have a gift for you. Speaking of
that's
gifts,
right. That's right.
I haven't sent it over yet, but we do have it.
Okay.
So it is a toy though.
It is a toy
of,
is it the Happy
Mr.
Meal
Cort-
Ralph?
Mr. Cortez himself. It is, the
oh
dad
my
of
gosh.
Antonio Banderas.
Yes.
Antonio. That
yes,
is incredible.
Gregoria, you can take Gregorio home. Zorro himself. He's
thank you
for
so
you.
Much.
I don't think we've had somebody be this happy for.
I have a new. I just actually moved into this apartment in K-Town, so I'm in dire need of some Gregorio Cortez's to decorate my apartment with. So thank
right.
you.
Right, 'tis the season. We'll find a Santa hat to put on him. You can dress him up for all the holidays. But anything you want to promote while you're here?
Well, I guess you mentioned my podcast is the Pagan Angel Network, or PAN for short. You should be able to find us on any wherever you listen to, you know, this podcast. You should be able to find PAN as well. We are a horror themed podcast with a focus on like cosmic horror, Lovecraftian horror, generally a focus on narratives, although we have had a nonfiction series as well, like a more like a discussion series. We do original as well as classic, like audiobooks. We do a lot of tabletop game let's plays, which if you don't know what that is, I encourage you to give one a listen. They're a lot of fun. And of course, created by our very own Brett Ellison, we have our own original fully produced audio drama.
That's right.
Ocean Park, which is
Ocean
about
Park.
an amusement park. You know, I'm sure you're shocked to hear that it has to do with amusement parks.
Yeah,
knowing
Brett Ellison and theme parks have never come up before.
But it's an amusement park that Brett has created where mysterious things happen. I encourage you to give it a listen. It still makes me laugh every time I listen to
it's
some of the stuff that Brett wrote and that his cast recorded. So I strongly recommend you.
It's a ripoff of SeaWorld for people who don't know what I'm talking about.
It's like I would pitch. What have we called it? It's like it's kind of Scooby Doo, but
it's
like
Scooby Doo meets Stranger Things meets SeaWorld.
Yeah, that's it. Whoa. That's what it is.
Yeah. So check it out. A lot of the people who've been on the show, who've been on Monster Dream Podcast hosts and more, are in the show.
That is
so
true.
Check it out.
That is true. Keep your ears out for cameos.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thanks so much. I hope people enjoyed this existential look at Spy Kids 2. I know they were probably not expecting it. They probably aren't listening. Crying. They probably did not make it this far. Once they said, this is the best movie ever made, throws phone out the highway. If you like what you heard, you can follow us on Instagram and Twitter with the handle Most Extreme Pod. There's no E in extreme. And our TikTok as well. We got a TikTok. We've been making some TikToks. And and if you have any questions, email us at mostextremepodcast@gmail.com. And see Dune in IMAX, Denis Villeneuve's Dune in IMAX. It should still be playing, I believe. Bye! All right.
And cut.